This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dave Brooks, sitting in for Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Drama surrounded the House version of the state budget this week as lawmakers debated which areas of government should be sliced. One controversial funding cut concerned the Department of Transportation, which led to a Republican effort to raise the gas tax. After that effort failed, supporters like House Finance Chair Neil Kirk are looking for alternatives.
We will consider another way to solve this problem within the budget, and the services we expect from our Department of Transportation will be provided for the next 2 years. This is a two-year solution to the problem. It is not a long-term solution.
Also at the State House, some lawmakers were lampooned on national TV after comments they made on a bill from a group of fourth graders to make the red-tailed hawk the official state raptor. Democrat Rennie Cushing, the sponsor of the student's bill, sought to make amends.
Mr. Speaker, I want to stand here today and I want to apologize to the fourth graders of Lincoln Ackerman School and their teacher and their parents. And I want to apologize to every fourth grader and every parent in the state.
In presidential politics, the 2016 race gained its first official candidate this week. Texas Senator Ted Cruz made the announcement at Liberty University in Virginia. Meanwhile, in New Hampshire, the lesser-known and still unofficial candidate, John Kasich of Ohio, spoke at Politics and Pie in Concord.
Leaders don't take polls, ladies and gentlemen. You know, I try to tell my colleagues in the legislature, you do your job. If you worry about election or re-election, you won't be doing your job.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Dave Brooks from the Nashua Telegraph and GraniteGeek.org, sitting in for Laura Canoy, who's out gallivanting somewhere. So let us hear from you. You can call in. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests today here in the studio are Gary Reno, State House reporter for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. Hi.
Good to be here, Dave.
Kathleen Ronayne, who's New Hampshire State House and politics reporter for the Associated Press. Hello.
Good morning.
And Dean Spiliotis, who's civics scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University and author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Good to have you.
Hi, Dave.
So we'll start with the budget because kind of everything depends on the budget in New Hampshire these days, and lots of back and forth on it with the Department of Transportation at the center of it all. So, Gary, this started in the State House Finance Committee. Can you fill us in on the overall plan that the committee approved along party lines, I think?
It was along party lines. It was a very partisan vote almost all the way through, with except one division that was a little more united than the others. But essentially, it's an $11.2 billion budget, which is about $300 million, $400 million less than the budget that Governor Hassan proposed. However, the general fund spending, which is one of the keys here, how much is the state actually spending, is a little less than it was in the last biennium. And as usual, you know, you take about $400 million in a $11 billion budget, it's not a lot of money, so to speak, in relative terms. However, the issue is where are the cuts and where are the reductions? And that's what's really been controversial about this budget. I mean, they have a real problem with the highway fund. Cars are becoming more efficient, so we have less gas tax going into it. People are driving cars longer, so the registration fees are going down. And so for years and years and years, we've been trying to backfill the highway fund. We sold I-95 to the Turnpike system and the I-95 bridge to the Maine and things like that. We've done all these one-time things, and it finally, everybody knew it was going to come crashing down, and it did this time. And so the tune of about $100 million short, which translated into about $88 million for the Department of Transportation. It's somehow they had to find money to fund.
This seems like a really bad time to be talking about cutting the Department of Transportation when we've been watching the snowplows spend their whole life out. What about Kathleen? Is that something that people are freaking out about?
Yeah, you know, I think that's been part of the discussion at the State House, and that's part of why we've heard Republican lawmakers say that we need to find a way to make sure this cut doesn't go through. And we've heard in the committees, there's been a lot of discussion from Democrats and Republicans, you know, thanking the transportation workers and saying this is really not a time to be putting people out of work. The department said these cuts could have resulted in up to 700 layoffs. And I mean, when you think about what that does, not only to those workers, but to the state's ability to maintain roads and bridges, it was basically going to turn over any non-state owned roads to local towns and cities and say, plow them yourself. So
they'd be really enthusiastic about that.
Yeah, I think there's definitely an acknowledgement on both sides of the aisle that this is not something we can afford to do. And that's why Republicans started talking about a gas tax increase. I mean, that's pretty unheard of. We just raised the gas tax last year and they were talking about doing it again. Obviously that failed. Failed to even get a debate on the floor. And that's why they had to turn to the university system, the Renewable Energy Fund, other ways to stop this cut in DOT. And I think a lot of times in budgeting, you'll see Republicans maybe say, well, we can be more efficient in this department. This cut's okay. We don't need to be increasing spending. But mm-hmm. the DOT budget was really an area where Republican leadership, not every Republican, but the leadership was saying we cannot afford to make this cut.
How serious was the talk about a gas tax increase from Republicans? I mean, that
Neil Kirk, chairman of the Finance Committee, who's a Republican and certainly not a tax and spender, was saying that this is something that we should consider. But I think, you know, broadly among Republican leadership, this was really a non-starter. There was not support for it in the majority office. Uh-huh. I think that, you know, it was people talked about it like it was a possibility, but they would have needed probably 70, 80 Republicans to vote for it. And clearly that wasn't possible because they didn't even debate it on the floor. So it kind of created this chaos where it was the plan for about a week and then you get to the floor the day of and they're not going to vote for it. And so we have to go back to the table and where are we going to find the money from? And it's just kind of another step in what has been a pretty chaotic process of the House putting its budget together.
And often we have budgets that go together and it's very difficult and we have to go through all the hand-wringing. But what we usually have is the young versus the old. Who are we going to fund, the young people or the old people? And that's usually the balance. How do we balance these two things?
You mean like education versus retirement
and things like that, nursing homes versus education. However, this time I'll say this for them. They put about 25 different balls in play. Mm-hmm. We have the young, the old. We have the developmentally disabled. We have the highways. We have people with rooms and meals on wheels and things like that. I mean, it's just endless things that have been put in play here with this budget that usually aren't put in play. And it's just created a lot of, as Kathleen says, a lot of chaos.
Yeah, I mean, these are some key political areas when you think about transportation infrastructure is always important to people, particularly driving around the roads in recent days. You see how much work is going to need to be done going into the summer. Education, parents want to send their kids to the University of New Hampshire system. That's problematic. You know, we knew the gas tax was dead on arrival in the Senate. Turns out it didn't even get a vote in the House. You know, the problem here for budget writers is they're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. On the right, they have kind of the more conservative wing of the House led by Bill O'Brien who want deeper cuts and no new taxes. And then on the other side, you have Democrats who are pushing and saying, no, these are core areas that we need to fund as a state. It's part of our responsibility to fund, energy conservation and education and transportation. So, but it is interesting, you know, you watch the coverage coverage or you read about it. And then, you know, they will at some point check in with Chuck Morris over in the Senate, and everybody seems very calm over there and says, you know, we're going to – there's some important issues being raised, but we're going to start from scratch. We'll have better revenue estimates in May after we see what happens in April, which is a big month for revenue. So there is a lot of chaos. There are some interesting political dynamics, but I think there's still time for it to shake out in the coming months.
Kathleen?
Yeah, I think Dean brings up a few important things. You know, this process is far from over. We don't need a budget in place until the end of June when the existing budget ends. So this is going to go over to the Senate. It's pretty much assumed that the Senate is not really going to build off what the House is doing. The Senate's going to do their own thing. So they're going to have a little more time to put together a budget. They are going to have some better revenue estimates. And really, this is all going to get sorted out, you know, in committee of conference time when both of the sides come together. And one of the big differences between the governor's budget and the House budget is the House has not accepted any of her means for bringing more revenue into the state. Right. So she proposed an increase in the cigarette tax, an increase in car registration fees, you know, closing what she said were a couple other, you know, business tax loopholes that would have brought in more money to do some of the things that she had wanted to do. And the House are saying, you know, they're saying we were elected, Republicans were elected to not raise taxes or fees, so we're not going to go for this. And what we have now is we have to live within our means. We have to find ways to make this budget work. So that's how they're justifying some of the changes
well, and they've premised
that they're making.
They premised their entire election campaign in November as the state has a revenue a spending problem, not a revenue problem. So if they start accepting a lot of the governor's revenue proposals, then it looks like they're kind of going back on their platform from the November election.
So we have a Facebook comment here that, speaking of revenue, who says, this is Ray from Whitefield, who says, when are our legislators going to have the intestinal fortitude to institute a sales or income tax, which is his preference, to solve the state's revenue woes? The proposed cut in the DOT budget is so short-sighted as to be an insult to anyone with an iota of intelligence, says Ray of Whitefield. I assume we're not going to be seeing any income or sales tax proposed.
I wouldn't hold my breath on
okay.
that. I think though, what we coming up against here is next week is the House is going to vote on the budget. And we have – if you're Sean Jasper, the House Speaker, you have a real problem. Because when you started work on this budget, you had – really two options. You either could go to the right and help hope that you can get the Bill O'Brien element of the House to support you, or you can go to the left and get the Democratic support. They chose to go to the right. And whether they get enough of that support is going to be key, because otherwise I don't think they have enough votes. They're going to need almost all of Bill O'Brien's supporters to vote for this.
So coming up,
going down.
More chaos then. All right. Well, anyway, coming up here on the Friday News Roundup, we're going to have more State House news, more presidential hopefuls in the state, of course, and some changes in store for the moose hunting season, and, of course, fallout from that red-tailed hawk bill. Stay with us for more Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Dave Brooks of the Nashua Telegraph and GraniteGeek.org. I'm sitting in for Laura Kanoi. We're covering some of the top stories of the week: budget battles, an unexpectedly controversial energy bill, big changes from moose hunters, and, of course, fallout from that red-tailed hawk bill. Join us with your thoughts. You can call in. The exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You find us on Facebook or Twitter. So let's turn from the budget to something else that was happening in the State House, a rather different bill of interest. This one pits school administrators against students and privacy advocates, and bullying fears are at the center of the debate. Kathleen, can you talk about this for a minute?
Yeah, so there's a bill before lawmakers right now that would basically say that schools, and that includes public secondary education schools as well as higher education, saying that administrators cannot compel or ask kids to turn over information about their social media accounts. I guess I didn't realize that this is something that people were doing, but I think, you know, right now under state law, you could, ask a kid for their Facebook password or for their Twitter password, or if, it's higher education, maybe you want to look at those things before you give a kid a scholarship or let them join a club. So there's this bill that says administrators can't do this. And on the one hand, you've got privacy advocates who say, you know, students deserve to have their privacy protected, their life outside of school protected. You know, schools should have no business in this. But On the other side of the issue, you have people that say, well, it's really important that in issues of bullying, when there needs to be an investigation, that administrators have the ability to figure out what's going on. And there was a hearing at the State House this week, and a teenager with autism testified before the committee and said, I've been bullied in school, and people have been taking pictures of me and posting them online, and I don't want this bill to go through because that might hurt the school's ability to do something about it. So
that was pretty compelling testimony from a Sauhegan High School freshman, I believe it was.
Yeah, and I think that it just goes back to this whole issue of when can kids be punished in school with what they're doing on their private social media accounts. I mean, it's slightly different, but we kind of saw this in Bedford a couple months ago when some kids were tweeting mean things about the superintendent and got suspended. So I think it all goes back to this issue of what's private and what has to do with school.
And part of the issue, though, I think is, I mean, there is a balance between privacy rights and protecting students. But I think part of the issue is allowing schools to be proactive. So, you know, we've read many stories in the last couple of years about cyberbullying and young people committing suicide or harming themselves in other ways as a result of being bullied. So the question is, you know, if something happens, then after the fact we have investigations and people look at social media. But, you know, giving schools an ability to take a look at these things in advance may be a way of kind of short-circuiting ongoing bullying. So that, I think that's the question. But, you know, there are privacy rights as well. So it's a tough balance to strike.
It is. And last year we had two bills that passed. One passed the House and one passed the Senate, and they couldn't quite agree on something in between, and they both went down. But last year we didn't hear anything like this student from Sauhegan coming in and talking about it. I mean, you had the opposition from the law enforcement community and concern from the school administrators and school boards association and saying you're going to be hindering our ability to go in there and do something about this. But we never had someone like this student come in, which really kind of makes it very real and, as Dean says, makes it a very touchy kind of
– gives a face to the problem.
And makes it a very touchy issue. And how do you walk the fine line here?
And it's always a problem with students. I would talk about First Amendment rights are always fighting over that. Can you take the high school newspaper and censor it or not? Because it's a student, so that's the same idea. It's not quite an adult, but they're not quite not adults either. So, yeah.
And most states that have similar laws to like this are for college and universities, and they don't go down to secondary and elementary school levels like this law would, which just makes it a little bit more complicated.
It even goes to elementary level?
It does.
Wow. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that. So, all right. Well, speaking of adults, sort of adults anyway, let's go to presidential candidates who are still coming and, of course, will be coming through next year. So, Dean,
yes.
Ohio Governor John Kasich was here early this week. So tell us about him.
Well, John Kasich is elected governor of Ohio in 2011. Listeners may remember him as a member of the U.S. Congress. He served in the House for 18 years. He was a fairly senior member, very well known at that time. Then ran for president in 2000 briefly, didn't go particularly well, and he got out. Became a broadcaster for a little while, did some other things, and then got back into politics in his home state. And he's been a very, very successful, you know, reasonably popular governor in Ohio, where he's been able to get reelected in a state that is often considered a swing state. You know, he's more moderate than some of what we've been hearing from people like Ted Cruz, for example, who we'll talk about. You know, he took the expanded Medicaid money for Obamacare. He supports Common Core. He's open on immigration in terms of figuring out how to deal with people who are already here. So he's, you know, a little bit more moderate. Some people might call him establishment candidate. He's being sort of very coy about where he's really interested or not. He has the kind of resume that, you know, sort of establishment types in the party think is very viable for a general election. So a la sort of the discussion around Jeb Bush, or even a Mitt Romney back in the last election. So the question for Kasich is, you know, does he have the fire in the belly to do this? It's not clear. And is he willing to kind of duke it out with the conservatives in the party who are kind of fed up with centrist candidates like a Ted Cruz and others? And, you know, he made a few comments about how good he is at compromise and that it shouldn't be all about ideology and partisanship. All that stuff I think will play well in a general. The question is, how will it play in the primary? Probably better here than, say, in a place like Iowa or South Carolina.
Fire in the belly. Love that phrase.
Yeah, I think something that's really interesting about Kasich, and this is something that Dean just mentioned, you know, he does support Common Core. He did take the Medicaid expansion money. And I think what we're starting to see from candidates like Jeb Bush or, you know, Lindsey Graham, who do support immigration reform, Common Core, they're coming out right now, they're talking a lot about standing by your principles, not compromising. You know, I'm not going to back away on these issues that they know are tricky with the base. And it's going to be interesting to see if what they're saying now about not compromising on Common Core and all these things, as we get deeper and deeper into the primary and they have to start duking it out a little bit with more conservative candidates, whether they hold the line on those kind of key issues that they're very different from a certain segment of their party, because they're talking and coming out right now and saying, you know, you have to be principled, you can't change your mind. So we'll end up seeing, and I'm not saying that I think they're going to, but it's, you know, there's this very clear divide on some of these issues.
Well, I think it's very interesting. Is the first two states that we have selection for the presidential selection process, it's Iowa and New Hampshire. And Iowa has turned very hard right in recent years, particularly in the Republican primary, and whereas New Hampshire is much more moderate. So, I mean, these guys are walking a fine line if they're going to be campaigning in Iowa or New Hampshire, because they're really playing to two different audiences almost.
New Hampshire is much more moderate.
Moderate than Iowa.
Well, than Iowa, yeah, absolutely.
I wouldn't.
And Dean, speaking of candidates, we have an actual real candidate. We don't have to talk about sort of maybe candidates anymore. Right. You want to talk about Ted Cruz?
Ted Cruz, first-term senator from Texas, has announced that he's running. Had this big kickoff at Liberty University in Virginia, founded by Jerry Falwell. Kind of a big play for social conservatives and evangelicals, kind of the same turf that Mike Huckabee and Rick Santorum typically play on. He's someone who has been very active kind of in terms of visibility in recent years. He sort of was involved in that partial government shutdown in 2013, did a little bit of filibustering. His argument is that Republicans consistently make the mistake of nominating a moderate. What they need is a true principled conservative, and that will bring out conservatives to vote, thereby winning the presidency. He's going to have a tough challenge here in New Hampshire. He's polling at about 4%. He's seventh or eighth on the list. New Hampshire has a lot of independents who vote in the Republican primary, so it's not clear how he's going to reach them. He's here, I think, today to have a rally with sort of the Tea Party, to sort of unite the Tea Party crowd behind him. But it's going to be a challenge. I have yet to see kind of how he reaches beyond the sort of 25% of the electorate who consider themselves, you know, pure conservatives. That's going to be his challenge. But he's a very colorful guy, very outspoken, very quick on his feet, and he'll certainly be a big part of the discussion.
Yeah, I just want to say one thing I love about this Ted Cruz story is that he makes his announcement at Liberty University, and then there are news reports that they're requiring students to attend the announcement. So,
$10 fine.
And they get fined if they don't show up at Liberty University. So I just think it's kind of a funny little twist. Yeah.
Excellent. So, joining us now is Sam Evans Brown, who is New Hampshire Public Radio's environment and education reporter, and we're going to talk about two very different stories. Hi, Sam.
Hi there.
So the first one is about a solar energy bill. There was a hearing in the House this week, and there'll be some more, and you were there, that it would basically make it easier for public utilities, regulated utilities, to own solar panels, which sounds kind of awesome. Is it?
Sounds kind of awesome, unless you're in the business of putting solar panels on the rooftops of residential businesses or residential ratepayers, in which case you might be worried that you're going to get squeezed out of the business, which is what we saw. We saw a couple of out-of-state companies that are not operating in New Hampshire right now, Sunrun being the biggest one, who organized kind of a campaign, a letter-writing campaign, and flooded the email.
Flooded is the word.
Absolutely. I had a legislator tell me that he's been there for 18 years, and this was top five most emails he's gotten on a subject. And a lot of them seem to have come from people who don't even live in New Hampshire,
yeah.
which makes you makes them. I think the Sunrun sort of overplayed their hand here. It was seen very skeptically the whole campaign. But and the meanwhile the sponsor of the bill had heard from one constituent. She obviously wasn't on the list of emails that people were told to contact.
So this is kind of a complicated issue. Can you tell us very quickly what it is?
Yeah. So the original bill did a number of things, most of which were stripped out. The solar industry is really interested in lifting the cap on net metering. Right now, only a certain percentage of customers can net meter, which is an incentive to install solar panels.
You can get paid back if you generate X.
Right. You run your meter backwards. Right. And that was struck out. There's also this thing called group net metering, allowing you to share your panels between you and some friends or colleagues. And they were trying to make that easier. And that provision was struck out. And then there's this also kind of non-controversial provision that will allow people to get a property tax exemption on geothermal heating in their homes. It's enabling legislation. Mm-hmm. If towns want to get on board, that was still there. But then the one that everyone got fired up about is this language that would make it easier for utilities to own solar panels, either residential or otherwise, maybe on firehouses and on school grounds, and then get paid back for those solar panels through energy rate, so the distribution rate that everyone pays on their bill. And I think the reason that we saw this pushback to it is that you've seen this in other states, specifically Arizona. This has been a big headline fight in Arizona.
Big fight.
And it's seen by the solar installers as a way to squeeze them out of the business by utilities who are not very serious about solar.
This is part of a bigger picture, is that solar power, of course, the price of solar power is just plummeting to the point where there's some talk where it's actually starting to become a viable alternative to certainly coal-fired and maybe even natural gas-fired power plants in other parts of the country, not necessarily here, but maybe here soon. And so there are some utilities that are afraid or concerned that this might really be undermining their whole business model.
Right. There was this report out of the Edison Electric Institute, which is the sort of umbrella trade group that represents all the utilities, that identified distributed generation, rooftop solar in particular, as an existential threat to their business. And ever since then, there has the fight against solar panels has heated up in a lot of places. I mean, the industry really hasn't taken off here in New Hampshire like it has, say, in Massachusetts yet. So I think the fight here is sort of just a shadow of what it is in other places. But we're seeing those ripples of it even here.
Part of the reason it's taken off in Massachusetts, however, is that the utilities are allowed to build and own certain, in very, very specific, limited, but they can build some. And they've built some, the utilities down in Massachusetts have built some megawatt size plants, none of which exist in New Hampshire.
And this gets to kind of the interesting wrinkle here, is that even though we had these out-of-state groups lobbying against the bill, our state Sustainable Energy Association at first was okay with this bill and even said they felt like it was okay for utilities to have some skin in the solar game as long as it was at a reasonable level. So, you know, the out-of-state, in-state, dynamic is really kind of interesting here.
And speaking of interesting things, an entirely different topic, the moose hunt. You see how quickly you can jump from one topic to another.
Yeah.
You had a story today about how the moose hunt is likely to be curtailed.
Yeah, so, and not in the whole state. We should get that out there right at the start. Fish and Game has set sort of regional cutoffs. So if the population density of moose in a given region drops below a certain level, they're going to stop the moose hunt in that region. The two regions where it's getting close is in the central New Hampshire and southwestern New Hampshire, so sort of lakes region south and then Keene area. In southeastern New Hampshire, the moose densities are also very low, but they will not stop the hunt there because they're so concerned about collisions with cars in that very populous area of the state. They're just going to keep the hunt no matter what. But they said that in central New Hampshire, it could stop as soon as this fall, though they don't know yet. That's just sort of what they're thinking. And then southwestern New Hampshire, maybe it'll take a few years.
So for our listeners who have not ever gotten a moose hunting permit, well, you go to join the lottery, you pay money to join the lottery, and you get, if you're lucky, you get a permit, and it's for a specific location. It's not just you can wander around anywhere trying to find a moose. You have to go to a specific spot.
Right. There are six I think there are six wildlife management units that the state has been chopped up into. So you've got three in the North Country, Connecticut Lakes, White Mountains, and then North, which is sort of in between them. And you've got Central, Southwest, Southeast. And so it's really south of the White Mountains that this is a concern.
And the underlying problem that has led to this is?
So this is what the biologist complains about. She's like, winter tick has gotten all the headlines. In the North, winter tick is the problem. In the South, it's a parasite called brain worm.
And the problem being that the
deer populations, yeah. Right. So brain worm is carried in deer, and we now have deer and moose populations overlapping in a way that didn't used to happen. It used to be moose hung out where the snow was very deep and deer had a hard time up there, and then down where there was no snow, moose had a hard time, and now they're crossing in a way they hadn't before, and this parasite, which is harmless to deer, is killing lots of moose.
And so basically the population has fallen to the point they were talking about, I believe, calf death rate of 30-40%, some staggering number from last winter. It's fallen to the point where they just don't want to hunt it anymore.
Yeah, and they said we're just going to stop and see where the population bottoms out. And Massachusetts still has hung on to a couple hundred moose, despite the fact that they have more deer, per acre of forest than we do. That's kind of the guess is that might be where we wind up, is just a few hundred moose down here in South.
Oh wow, and New Hampshire's not alone, by the way. Minnesota, which has even more of a hunting tradition than New Hampshire, frankly, they ended their entire moose hunt a couple years ago because of brain worm out there. And basically, the moose all across the northern U.S. are being – and actually, this is the case in Europe as well. Presumably climate change, but things that are changing are affecting them to the point that their population is not doing well.
And it's a complicated picture. I mean, in each area, in each region, it's a slightly different, series of vectors that are pushing the population down. So even between northern and southern New Hampshire, it's a different set of forcings.
And get to the economic side. The moose hunt is a big deal money-wise, publicity-wise. It's sort of part of the image of what is New Hampshire above and beyond just, in a way that, say, the turkey hunt isn't.
Right, exactly. I mean, even though it's only, I think the statistic was 6% of hunters in the state are seeking moose because, it's obviously a very tightly controlled hunt compared to deer or turkey. It's very iconic. There are guides who make their living just taking folks out to bag their moose because a lot of people, they sign up for the lottery. They've never hunted moose before because it's like a 1 in 70 chance that you might get the permit. So you need help.
There's a woman who's on my historical society with me in town. When she got a lottery for the moose hunt, she was pumped. Anyway, so coming up, we're going to turn to some other topics in the news this week, including that flap over how some House lawmakers handled a bill presented by fourth graders. So stay with us for more Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Dave Brooks of the Nashua Telegraph, sitting in for Laura Kanoy. Before we move on to another topic, just an email message we just got, and we were talking about presidential candidates. Christopher of Manchester sent in from his BlackBerry, by the way. I didn't know people still use BlackBerries. He sent in an email saying, the word I would use to describe Kasich is, quote, pragmatic. Refreshing to see after several cycles of ideological Republican candidates who easily become laughingstocks and targets of the mainstream media, that darn mainstream media, and targets of activists on the Democratic left. So that's just a comment from Christopher of Manchester. Now we're going to move on to a topic that, frankly, drew more attention to New Hampshire than anything has happened in the last couple weeks, a bill to make the red-tailed hawk the state raptor. We've talked about this before, but it's still around. So, Gary, can you remind us what's happened and where we are?
Well, we had the fourth-grade class from the Lincoln Atkinson School in Hampton Falls go through the process that a lot of fourth-grade classes go through, which is to come up with a plan for a state something or other, official state bird, official state vegetable, et cetera, and get somebody to sponsor the bill and then go through the whole legislative process as a learning experience for the fourth-grade class. Well, the kids from Lincoln Atkinson School decided that they wanted to try to make the red-tailed hawk the state raptor. And the bill went through the usual process. They got Hampton Representative Rennie Cushion to sponsor it. They had the public hearing. They came up, testified at the public hearing. And actually, when they were – the committee, the environmental committee, was deciding on what recommendation they wanted. There was actually a red-tailed hawk that they brought into the legislative office building. So it was all very well and good until it gets to the House floor. And those fourth-grade students are sitting up in the gallery. And several lawmakers expressed their opinions concerning the whole issue of bringing such issues before them when they had, as they say, much bigger fish to fry, if we will. And particularly one representative from Rochester, Warren Groen, got up and in his speech likened the hawk to Planned Parenthood, bringing in the whole abortion issue. And a YouTube of his speech went viral, and away we went.
Away we went. Kelly?
Yeah, I think, you know, there are a couple of things at play here. One, I think why it got so much attention is because of the Planned Parenthood comments. And I also what was interesting is people have, of course, talked to the school since this happened. And the teacher, the principal, one of them said, you know, the kids, they didn't really understand that. They don't know what Planned Parenthood is. So on the one hand, you've got parents who are saying, well, now my kids, my fourth grader is asking me what Planned Parenthood is. And this is really an appropriate time for that discussion. But the thing that the school officials were saying is that the kids were more upset that they felt that the lawmakers seemed to be making fun of them. So you have a couple lawmakers, a Democrat, a Republican, get up there and they start saying this is a waste of our time. Of course, they go on to debate it for a solid, you know, 10 minutes about how much of a waste of time it is. And, you know, we have too many of these state symbols. We shouldn't be doing this. What are we going to have next? You know, this year they also have a bill up, I think, to make the mastodon the state fossil and the bobcat the state wildcat. So these are things that kind of come up again and again and again. But, you know, I think that what really upset a lot of lawmakers as well is that, you know, New Hampshire legislature is now a national laughingstock. And I think we see that happen, you know, every so often. One out of 400 says something that catches the national headlines. And there we go. Everybody's laughing at New Hampshire. I mean, John Oliver did a little segment about it, and it was national news everywhere. So it just doesn't make people happy that this is kind of the national image of New Hampshire.
So Dean, is that a big deal that you know, affects our image?
It's interesting. You know, whenever something like this happens, I get calls and emails from friends of mine in the national media who say, hey, what's going on up in New Hampshire with that, you know, that citizen legislature of yours with the 400 representatives who are, you know, elected and you get $100 a year. You know, with a big legislature such as we have, you're going to see all kinds of interesting and eccentric behavior. But what I found so fascinating about these particular remarks on Planned Parenthood is I'm always interested to see politicians, and I see this both on the far right and on the left, where people's thinking about politics is so constrained by ideology that it really kind of trumps common sense. So, you know, for this particular representative, this sort of, you know, the red hawk killing its prey by tearing it apart with its talons.
Limb from limb.
It was just like too good for him to pass up. He immediately equated it with, oh, that's, you know, Planned Parenthood. I think part of that is the social mediaization of politics, that, you know, people, because they spend so much time on social media doing this kind of snarky behavior, you sort of lose your ability to have the proper filter in public. So it just you could see this wasn't somebody getting caught on an open mic in a private comment. This gentleman thought this was the appropriate sort of remark to make. And it's a function of being so tightly constrained by ideology, particularly on social issues, that you can't help yourself. And again, this is not just Republicans. I see it with progressives on the far left as well. And it's just sort of their kind of worldview and how they interact in public. And I think it's unfortunate. And you know, hopefully the students will move on from this.
Kathleen?
Yeah, just one other thing that I think has been interesting is now that it's gone viral, what the reaction has been. So John Burt, one of the representatives who made some of the comments on the floor, not the Planned Parenthood comments, came into the press room and he started playing us voicemails that he's getting on his cell phone from people across the country that are really nasty messages. People who saw the video online and were so mad about it that they felt compelled to look up his phone number and call him and tell them just how mad they were. So it's this very – it's just really taken on a life of its own, and it's interesting to see kind of the vitriol of the people reacting to it as well. And now, of course, you know, we saw –
apologies?
We saw the House this week. You know, Warren Groen said he wasn't going to – I don't know if he said he wasn't going to apologize, but he didn't apologize.
I think he said he stood by his
But
remarks.
The, you know, the state, the speaker and the majority leaders and Representative Cushing, they all came out and said, we really need to, you know, make it clear that we appreciate this youth participation in government. And they passed a resolution saying, you know, good job, fourth graders. We appreciate you. And Rennie Cushing got up on the floor and apologized. So it's, you know, one person's comments. Now all the other lawmakers are trying to walk it back and say, you know, he doesn't stand for all of us. We appreciate this. So it's been this kind of really spiraled out of control. I think it happened like 3 weeks ago, and it's still, you know, going on.
Now, it's still up in the Senate, perhaps? There was some talk about the possibility of the Senate bringing it back along with the Bobcat.
There is talk of it being attached to a bill that's coming over from the House and sending it back to the House so that they may have another opportunity to rethink their
action. They can bring the hawk back?
Bring the hawk back.
Excellent. Yeah. Can I just say from the Granite Geek point of view that I was very disappointed that the fossil got taken down. I was looking forward to the mastodon there, so I must say. So, all right, let's move on to another topic, another sort of iconic New Hampshire thing, which is the Pumpkin Fest in Keene, which, of course, I assume all of you have been to it. I certainly took my kids there, and it got wrapped up last year in the riots that really weren't associated with it, but they sort of were. And now the question is whether it's even going to happen. Let's see. The Planning, Licenses, and Development Committee in Keene unanimously recommended not to give a license to the Let It Shine folks to run it. Is the Keene Pumpkin Festival dead?
Well, the committee has twice voted to not give them a license. It came up before the council earlier, and then they decided that they really needed a public hearing, and so they put it off, sent it back to the committee, and it's coming up again this week. But from all indications, it looks like that there may not be another pumpkin festival this year, that's for sure.
We got a Facebook comment on this from Kendis, if that's how to pronounce it, Kendis Mass, who said, this seems ludicrous. End the tradition because of idiots? Just get more police, have volunteers stand watch, put up security cameras. Why not be proactive instead of reactive? Just a reminder, the riots that happened there were actually at least partly triggered by a, let's see, there was a national group that sets up raves, and they had, they told people to come to the Pumpkin Festival so they could film it. And they film people partying and they put it up, and that's how they make their money. And that was actually a lot of the prod that happened. It wasn't specifically related to the Pumpkin Festival, which is part of what irritates the Pumpkin Festival organizers so much, as well as Keene State College, of course. If it does get killed there, do you think somebody else? I mean, I know I've heard some people in Nashua saying, hey, we should have it. do you think that's feasible, or has it been tainted too much?
It certainly seems as though it's grown and grown and grown. So obviously, I mean, people have a real interest in it. And it just it's too bad that this all had to come down. But, I mean, they had problems the year before, but it wasn't quite as severe as it was this year.
You know, one question is, and I don't have a clear read on this, is whether or not the kind of payoff for businesses in the community outweighs the potential cost of providing adequate security and staffing it in the way that it needs to be staffed. And in fairness, part of this was an issue really for Keene State and kind of figuring out how to better police the student population. It's hard to know. This was supposed to be the 25th anniversary. They could, you know, sort of mark it off of that. I think these kinds of festivals are desirable for cities, but until you reach the point where the cost outweighs the benefits, and that's what the debate has been about, whether the cost really outweighs the benefits. I don't have a clear sense on that. Some people say yes, others say no. Maybe someone else will pick it up.
Okay, we're going to go to a caller here who has – oh, we are not going to go to a caller here. Never mind. My apologies. So, that's it. I mean, I personally would love to see, you know, those giant walls of pumpkins be set up again because they were very cool. But I can understand how you might be a little alarmed about it. Another intriguing story that came down was the possibility that a fraternity at Dartmouth College, which is certainly a school that has a history of fraternities, might have branded some of its members as part of an initiation ritual. This actually came up initially on the website Gawker, which was tipped off by somebody. And in typical modern media presentation, their story consists of screenshots of Reddit comments and things like that. And the idea is that somebody did, in fact, get branded on their buttocks, and it went bad, and they had to go to the doctor's office.
Yeah, I think so. It's the Alpha Delta fraternity, and I'm pretty sure this is a fraternity that had some problems last year with violating the university's alcohol
rules. They were already on probation.
Yeah, so they were already in a little bit of trouble. And what the officials are saying is that nobody was, you know, the branding was not mandatory, that anybody who chose to do this did it voluntarily. It was not a condition of joining the fraternity. You know, Dartmouth has had a lot of bad headlines lately, I think, you know, for various things, whether it's, you know, these alcohol violations, whether it has to do with sexual assault on campus. So I think that, you know, not very good spotlights on Dartmouth, and this certainly doesn't add to that. And I think it just, you know, across the country, we're just seeing more and more stories about behavior at fraternities that is really questionable, that schools want to distance themselves from, whether it's hazing, whether it's sexual assault, whether it's alcohol. So, you know, just another thing to add to that list that I think is starting to make people kind of question what, you know, what role do fraternities have on campus and what kind of crackdowns need to be happening.
I mean, this fraternity has a long history of problems. I mean, I think I'm correct here when saying that it was the prototype for the Animal House.
Yeah, yes. I believe that the fellow who wrote Animal House was a member of AD, as is the current president of Dartmouth. Interestingly enough, he was an AD in the 70s.
Wow. Oh, really? But that's part of their appeal. I mean, I'm sure it's much easier for them to get recruits because they can talk about Animal House. And so, yeah, you look at some of the comments that Gawker had about what it was like. The general comment was, you know, don't go down into their basement where the foosball tables are because it's kind of ugly down there. So we'll have to see. It was actually Dartmouth above and beyond that. They've talked about banning the sale of hard liquor on campus entirely.
I think they're doing it. They're banning hard liquor. Yeah.
Okay. All right. They're kind of wrestling with this with the whole issue, as are many colleges. So. And speaking of universities and interesting things happening, so what's going on at UNH Law School? Does anybody been following what's happened with Judge Broderick?
Well, you know, UNH Law School here in Concord, used to be Franklin Pierce Law School, established a few years ago the Rudman Center after late Senator Warren Rudman, Rudman Center for Public Policy within the law school, and it was the executive director was former Chief Justice John Broderick, who had been the dean of the law school prior to moving over to become the founding executive director of this center. And, you know, apparently he's had a falling out with the UNH administration. You know, he claims that they have not supported the mission of the center in the way that they had promised. He went public with it and resigned. Said he was forced out. They said, we're not forcing him out. So he released the letter from the university to the public so we could see, you know, what they were actually saying. And it certainly sounds like they were forcing it. They were banning him essentially from the he's not forced out. He resigned. But then the question was whether or not they were banning him from campus. It's a pretty ugly, constraining letter. Yeah. And we've had a couple, you know, high profile board members. Former Governor Steve Merrill, who was a law partner of Broderick's, has stepped down from the board of advisors. And it's a pretty high profile board. So a little bit of conflict there over the future of the center.
All right. So, well, we're just about wrapping up. So is anything interesting coming up next week? Who wants to tantalize us?
We have the House vote on the budget next week. That's probably going to be all day on Wednesday. We'll be back and forth. They're talking about locking the doors already. And they're also talking about a continuing resolution already, which is a little early for that. But we shall see. That's obviously the big news next week.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Gary mentioned this a little earlier, but it's going to be really fascinating to see how, you know, we all know there's kind of three factions in the House right now. There's the Democrats, there's the Republicans who support Jasper, and then there's the Republicans who support Bill O'Brien. So how does that all play out on the floor in this budget? There's going to be amendments after amendments. I'm sure there's going to be people challenging the speaker on various procedural things. So I think it's going to get pretty messy, and it'll be really the first big opportunity to see, you know, how big that Republican divide is and what it means for the budget. So
it's going to be the first big showdown between the O'Brien forces and the Jasper forces.
And does the vote have to happen on Wednesday? Or
well,
they're supposed to send it by April 2nd.
April 2nd is their deadline.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'll be following the politics of the budget like everyone else. It's really kind of interesting local politics. And then, you know, the presidential race continues to heat up. Ted Cruz is here today. There are going to be more people coming over the next week. So stay tuned.
All righty. And we are getting ready to head out. And just one other item. We have to say the news came out today. Say goodbye to Jose Montero, who's sort of the state's top health official. Anybody who listens to the show has heard Dr. Montero on it a number of times. He's a great guy, a lot of personality. He's been in a number of science cafes around the state, and he's moving on. Doesn't really say what he's doing to yet. We will miss him. He's a great guy. So The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Dave Brooks of the Nashua Telegraph and GraniteGeek.org, sitting in for Laura Kanoy. Thanks for joining us.